I mean, that's perfect description, John. Thank you. All right, so this is where the story begins. We get Danny, and he's working the room, man. He's working baggage claim. He's been working this convention. If you are here and you ain't met Danny yet, you've been in your room or hiding outside something, because Danny works the room. All right, so we get Danny, and we go out to the car, and we get in my SUV, and we start to leave. Well, there's a brother over here across from us, locked out of his little old Honda Civic. And he's either got his girlfriend or his sisters or somebody with him, his wife, I don't know. Danny says, look at that poor fool. No, here you go. Look at that poor bastard. So I said, well, what do you think, Danny? He says, hell, man, I can get that guy in there in 2 minutes flat. Three junkies, right, at the airport, breaking into somebody's car with a brother. And this guy, you know, he's looking like Tony Soprano. So I said, Danny, you sure you want to do this? Yeah, man, park the car. We get him out. So he says, you got any tools? I got this little tool kit. I mean, it looks more like a manicure kit, right? 2 minutes into it, Danny's done broke every damn screwdriver I got. So Danny says, we need a hammer. But Danny ain't looking for the hammer. He sends our friend John looking for a hammer. John goes find some poor innocent soul over here, some redneck bubba, and gets a pair of pliers and a hammer, comes over, and Danny's standing there, and his brother is getting pissed already. We've been there an hour. And I look over, I'm on one side of the car, and Danny's on the other with the brother, and he says, back up, man, back up. Guy says, man, you can't bust this window, this is my sister's car. And Danny starts shaking, man, like he's going into DTs. He says, I'm busting something. I looked over at Danny, and Danny's got this hammer, and it's a good-sized hammer, folks, and he's twirling it like a baton. He has got the itch. He says, somebody better grab this damn hammer. I'm going through the window. So we got a crowd drawn around by now. Security just rides by in waves. So Danny's got the hammer and one of these busted screwdrivers that ain't nothing but like a chrome nail at this point. He's got it up in the lock of the trunk of this thing. Kabam! 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 I mean, the lock is destroyed. We have wrecked this car. He's popping molding off the side. He's saying, don't worry about it, man. Which pops right back on it. I'm going, sure it does. So I look at my watch and I said, 2 minutes, Danny. Huh? 2 minutes? We done broke clothes hangers, all kinds of stuff. Anyway, we got the guy in his car, scared the hell out of him and his sister. He's probably got to take that poor Honda to a body shop. What would it cost him? $50 for a locksmith. It's probably going to cost him $500 now because the Oklahoma Mafia got a hold of it. Anyhow, without that, you know, with all that said, Danny's pretty exciting. And like I said, he just got back from London. And y'all, let's put it together for a southern welcome for Danny F.
Hi, everybody. My name is Danny, and I'm a cocaine addict. And that was the shittiest introduction I've ever got. Oh, man. Whew. It's good to be here. Before I forget, I'd like to thank Larry and the committee. They asked me to come out. It's an honor, and I'm glad to be here. I'm happy to be here. And I wasn't happy to be here when he first called me, because when he called me, he says, the way he asked me, he said, our speaker can't make it, and we need somebody. Would you come and talk for us? So, you know, right away, first thing I said is, I'm second choice. But I'm over that. I'm over that. So now I'm happy to be here. I really am.
You were third.
not over that anymore. It's been great weekend so far. And Mickey was great last night. Thank you, Mickey. Appreciate that. After Mickey finished last night, I went up to the room and I took the bathrobe out of my suitcase. Put it back in the closet. I said, damn. I thought it was mine. You know, I was like, yeah. You know, I like to fool around before I get started, you know, just to kind of loosen up a little bit. And I always joke around. I found this thing some years ago, and I always share it when I get a chance to come to the podium. And I've been blessed with many opportunities to come here and share my experience, strength, and hope. And this thing I'm going to share, which is a little show and tell, and I'm going to hold it up for you guys. And what it is, it's kind of something that I should have had some signs along the way long before I crossed that line that maybe I had a problem with alcohol or drugs. So I'm going to hold this thing up, and it's a picture of an old lady, and it says, before six beers. And I don't know how many people can see that, you know, but that's what it is. A picture that says, before six beers. What happens is, you take the same picture, you just turn it upside down like that, and it says, after six beers, and it becomes a princess. Now, if some of you guys, you know, maybe can relate. If you ever went to bed with Cindy Crawford and woke up in the morning with Lassie, that's a sign along the way that maybe you have a problem with alcohol. How do you know if you have a problem with cocaine? There's some signs along the way for that, too, that I never paid attention to. If the grocery delivery man is at your door with baking soda and Brillo, that's a sign that maybe you have a problem with cocaine. You know, I told that in London a couple of weeks ago, and nobody laughed. And after the meeting, a lady came up to me and said, you should have said aluminum. We would have laughed if you said aluminum. Another sign along the way that I should have had is if the voices in your head are grinding their teeth. That's a sign that maybe you have a problem with cocaine. I want to share with you some things tonight. I always talk about four things that are important to me and have real meaning in my life today. And I always share about the same four things. And the first thing is God. I talk about God. I have a loving, loving, powerful God in my life today, and a powerful connection with that God. And so I always acknowledge that and talk about God. Another thing that I always talk about and acknowledge is miracles. I like to talk about miracles. I'm a miracle. And I don't know most of you people, but I can pretty much bet that this room is full of miracles. Mm-hmm. Another thing that I always share about, I always talk about, is angels. I believe in angels. I believe that right now, right here, all around us is angels. And I believe that. And the fourth thing that I always talk about is the reason that I believe in the first three, and that's Cocaine Anonymous. I believe in Cocaine Anonymous. Now, if it were not for Cocaine Anonymous, I would not be able to talk to you about God. I wouldn't know anything about miracles, and I certainly wouldn't be in touch with the angels that are all around me. So I want to always acknowledge those things. They're important to me. I want to tell you this. I get real passionate when I have a chance to share. So, and sometimes in my sharing and as I get passionate, sometimes I offend people. And I'm not here for that. That's not what I'm here for. So if I do, I'm going to apologize now, get that out of the way. It's kind of like if you've ever been to a department store that's under construction, they have a sign up, excuse our dust, we're under construction. Well, if I offend anybody tonight, excuse my dust, I'm still under construction. God's not through with me yet either. But, you know, I'm going to share with you what it was like for me and what happened and what it's like for me today. And I was a real serious criminal, and I was a real serious dope fiend, and I'm real serious about this program of recovery, which means I have a lot of fun. And I get real passionate in sharing with you. If you see people around the rooms that have any sobriety and they're not laughing and having a good time, then they're not taking this program serious enough. So I want to get that out of the way and just let you know that I'm going to tell you some things. You know, I want to tell you, we're going to talk about cocaine tonight. We're definitely going to talk about cocaine. I'm not one that comes around and says, I can't stand cocaine. I hate cocaine. I want to see it again. It ruined my life. I hate it. I don't want to touch it. That's not, you know, that's not what it's about for me. I love cocaine. I love cocaine. That shit just don't love me. And so I'm going to talk to you about some of the insanity of cocaine in my life, and so you know that. But I want to tell you, first, I think it's important that I go back, and I always find, you know, when I hear people share, sometimes they get up to the podium and say, my name is so-and-so, and I was born on a rainy night in August in 19-something, and, you know. But I do want to tell you a little bit about my childhood. Larry said it. I live out in Oklahoma City today, but I'm born and raised in New York City in the Bronx. Can't tell, huh? Forget about it, yeah. And as far back as I could remember, there was always something wrong with me. And I think I heard Mickey talking about that last night. You know, I had that strange mental twist to my thinking as far back as I could remember. Way before I ever had a drink or a drug. And my earliest memories is about 6 years old. And in my neighborhood, I grew up, now, I know that last night they said don't curse from up here. And I'm gonna curse now. But it's only a curse here in Atlanta. Because I'm going to talk about the New York Yankees. Yes. Because growing up in the Bronx as a little kid, that for me, my life was the New York Yankees. And I just loved, I was just amazed and enthralled with the Yankees. And I had all the baseball cards of the Yankees when I was about 6 years old. Except for, I didn't have Roger Maris. I didn't have his card. And another little kid in my neighborhood, he had all the cards from the Yankees that year too, except for Yogi Berra. And he said to me, do you want to flip? And I said, sure. So we made an appointment to meet the next day to flip. And I went home and I was practicing flipping all day. Because, you know, it never crossed my mind that I might lose Yogi Berra. The only thing that I thought about was tomorrow I'm going to have Roger Maris. And I practiced flipping all day. And the next day I met him in the park and we went there and we flipped and he won. And all of a sudden it dawned on me that not only am I not going to get Roger Maris, I'm about to lose Yogi Berra. And something happened to me. It was such a drastic thing. I couldn't breathe. I got choked up and it was just too drastic of a situation and I couldn't let that happen. I kicked his ass. And I took all his baseball cards. And I learned a very important lesson that day. And the lesson was simple. If you can't get what you want the right way, you just kick some ass and take it. right after that, around the same year, it was maybe six, maybe seven, in my neighborhood where I grew up was a little Italian neighborhood in the Bronx, and we used to have the feast there every year. And a feast is an Italian festival. And they'd block off the streets, and they'd bring in the games and the food carts, and for 10 days everybody would just pig out and have fun. And my building was right there in the middle of the feast. And I remember going down to the feast, and I had a quarter. And in those days, for a quarter, you could buy a whole bag of candy. And I went to the cotton candy machine stand there, and I got a thing of cotton candy, and I ate it. It was good. I liked it. I wanted more. And for a quarter, I was able to get two of them. So I went back, and I got another one, and it was good. I liked it. I ate it all. I wanted more. I only didn't have no more money, though. So I went back up to the apartment, and one of my brothers had these... Remember those little old silver safes with the red dial? Remember those? Kind of you take a butter knife and pop it open? So here I was, like 6, 7 years old, cracking my brother's safe. And I get in there, and I take a half a buck, and I go back down to the feast, and I got more cotton candy. It was good. I liked it. I ate it, and I wanted more. And I ate up the whole 50-cent worth of cotton candy. It was good. I liked it. I wanted more, and I didn't have no more money. So I went back upstairs, and I went to my mother's purse. Oh, got more cotton candy. And I was eating the cotton candy. All of a sudden, I started getting paranoid. I'm thinking, you know, there's thousands of people all around me. I'm thinking somebody's going to say, where are you getting all this money for this cotton candy? So like they would even notice me, right? Little kid running around. So I went to the alleyway between two buildings, and I crouched down and I was eating my cotton candy. Twenty years later, in the same neighborhood, in a different alleyway, before I went up to see somebody in the building, I could remember ducking in there, taking the pipe out, and taking a blast, and having a flashback of that little kid doing the same thing. And you know what? The tendencies were the same. It was all the same thing. It didn't matter who I had to hurt, and who I had to disrespect, and who I had to step on. The only thing that mattered was I wanted something, and that was all that counted. And that's the way I lived my life, and that's the way I spent 22 years of my life, not respecting anybody or anything. Just whatever I wanted, it didn't matter who I had to step on or hurt. And it didn't matter if it was my brother's money, my mother's purse, that didn't matter. You know, and so those things very early in my life shaped who I was. You know, just take what you want. And just do what you want to whoever you want, whenever you want, however you want to do it. And so that's how I lived. When I finally got to the rooms of recovery in Cocaine Anonymous, I can remember my sponsor telling me, "You're going to go far in this program, Danny." And I said, "Thank you." And he said, "That's because you have so far to go." But I'm going to tell you, I want to tell you a little bit about my family growing up. I do not come from a dysfunctional family. My mother wasn't an alcoholic or an addict, and my father wasn't an alcoholic or an addict. And I really come from a very loving, kind Italian family. I can't stand up here and tell you I was abused and there was a drunk and this and that. There was dysfunction in my family in other ways, but it certainly wasn't with alcohol and drugs. And I did grow up with a whole lot of love. A whole lot of love. I come from my block, everybody was my cousin or something, and you know, I had 19 mothers and 22 fathers in my block, you know. So I come from a real loving family, you know. And I want to tell you about that, because there was a time in my life that I knew peace, and I felt at peace with myself and one with the world. And I never said, "Danny, you're at peace with yourself and one with the world," because I was just a little kid. But I had no fears and no worries and no anxieties, and I couldn't wait each morning to wake up and get to life, because life was good. And my father was a big man. He was a handsome man. He used to pick me up and hug me, and he used to say, "I love you, Danny." And I'd say, "I love you too, Dad." And life was good. My mother was a beautiful woman. She used to take me to her bosom and hug me. She'd say, "Danny, I love you." And I'd say, "I love you too, Ma." And life was good for me. My grandmother, she was from the other side. She didn't speak much English. But she used to hug me and say, "Benissa, Danny, Benissa." I'd say, Benasan, Noni. I love you too, Grandma. And life was good for me. And I remember that. And one night when I was 10 years old, I had three brothers and we all slept in the same room. And this particular night, I don't know why, but I couldn't sleep this night. And I was 10 years old, and I can remember it was late at night, and there was a knock on the door, and I kind of went out into the hallway, and I was listening. My mother went to the door, and there was a policeman there. And he told her there was a shootout, and my dad was dead. And, you know, I was 10 years old, and I never experienced death before. In about a half an hour, my apartment was full of people. And the men were in one corner whispering, and the women were in the other corner crying. And I went into the living room, and I said, what's going on? And somebody said, well, your daddy's dead. And I said, what does that mean? And they said, that means he's not coming back no more, Danny. And I want to tell you, I didn't know it then, and I didn't know it for 20-something years, almost 30 years later, really, when I got into this program. But that was the dividing line in my life. At that point in my life, I started building walls. And my pattern has been, through my inventory process, what I've been able to find out, is my pattern has been, I don't know how to allow you to love me. And a couple of years sober, I realized that. And for the last 7 years, I've made great progress in that area in my life. But that's been my shit all my life. You know? Because after that time, my mother would hug me and she'd take me to her bosom and she'd say, I love you, Danny. And I'd say, I love you too, Ma. On the outside. But on the inside, I'd be saying, uh-uh. And my grandmother would hug me and she'd say, Benasan, Danny. And I'd say, Benasan, Noni. On the outside. But on the inside, we'd say, no, we ain't doing that. And my pattern has been one after the other all my life. And I've been fortunate to have many women love me in my life, want to be a part of my life. And they say, I love you, Danny. I say, I love you too, baby. On the outside. But on the inside, we'd say, no, we ain't going there. You see, I didn't know how to allow you to love me. And that's a terrible place to be. But the good news is that realizing that at 2 years sober is half of the solution. The other half of the solution is doing some work in this program on that. And even if you have to go outside this program on that. You know, I didn't find it necessary to go outside. I found it just what I needed by applying these principles in my life to these areas. And it worked for me. You know, and today I'm at a point where I can allow somebody to love me. I'm free from that today. That's what we say in Cocaine Anonymous. We're here and we're free. And I am free from that. Because that's a terrible place to live in and a terrible... And I'm not going to go through a whole bunch of war stories, but I told you we're going to talk about cocaine, and we're going to talk about cocaine. And so I'm going to qualify. How many people are... Is this your first speaker meeting ever? Is there anybody here? Is your first... You guys missed Mickey last night? Your first meeting ever? First speaker meeting ever? Well, there's no doubt about it that I'm going to be the best speaker you ever heard. Let me give you my analogy of cocaine so we can remove any doubt about, you know, because sometimes, you know, we clean up good. Look at you people. You guys look good. You women look fine. You men look handsome. We clean up good. It's hard sometimes for a newcomer to say, that person's never been where I'm at. They don't understand me. So let me give you my analogy of cocaine. To me, cocaine was like the most beautiful woman in the world. The finest woman I've ever seen in my life. And I could be in a nightclub with 1,500 people around me, and there she is, my lady cocaine. Gotta have her. And I make my way through the obstacles in my life that are before me, and I make my way through all that stuff, and I get up to her, and I get lucky, and I get to leave with her. And we jump in a cab to go to her place, and all the way in the cab ride to her place, I got this thing going on in my stomach, just anticipating how good it's going to be. It's so much, it's right up to my throat. It's so powerful, even my butt is puckering. Just thinking about it. And we get up and we go to her place and we go to bed and man, best lovemaking I ever had in my life, just like I knew it was going to be. And when we're done, I get up to go to the bathroom, and she reaches under the bed and grabs a bat and pow, cracks my head open. Takes all my money, all my dope, all my jewelry. About 20 minutes later, I start coming to, and I stagger to my feet, and I'm dizzy, and I'm hurting, and I'm bleeding. And the first thing I say is, where is she? I gotta find her. I know she didn't mean it. I say, I know she loves me. And then I buy the lie one more time, and I tell myself, when I find her this time, it's gonna be different. Now, if you could relate to that, you are in the right place. Just hold on. Just hold on. That's my analogy of cocaine. What happened to me, in a real short synopsis of what happened to my life, is the first time that the police brought me home, I was 11 years old. You know, there was a connection there. My dad died when I was 10, and the police would bring me home at 11. I didn't know it. 12 years old, the judge gave me 6 months in reform school. 14 years old, another judge gave me 18 months in reform school. 16 years old, I was locked up for 2 years in a cell already. Wild. Crazy. 17 years old, I caught another case. And my mother at that time was dying of cancer. And the judge says, the judge wanted to give me time, and my mother went there and begged him not to lock me up. Begged him. And I stood in front of this man, and he says to me, son, you have a choice. You could take 3 years in prison or join the service. I said, where do you sign up? And I went into the army for 3 years, and I did 2 years in the army and 6 months in the brig and got a dishonorable discharge. You see, because the army don't play that shit either. And I came out, and I went right back to the neighborhood doing the same things. And I got to tell you that sometime while I was in the army, I married a lady from my neighborhood. It was what we Italians we call a shotgun wedding. She was pregnant. Her old man went, "You're gonna marry her?" And I said, "Of course." And we got married. We married 14 years, and so I had two beautiful daughters from that marriage. And so when I was 19 years old, I already had a wife and two kids, and I wasn't even a man. I was just a wild little kid running around. And so I'm running around the streets, and I came out, and I'm just doing all kinds of things, and I catch a 15-year prison sentence, and wound up doing 6.5 behind the wall on that. And every month, my wife used to come up 500 miles upstate New York and bring the two kids and spend the weekend, bring me packages, and stay there with me the whole time, you know. And when I come out of the joint in 85, man, I just went right back to doing the same thing, you know. I don't know, nothing different, and just running and gunning and getting high and doing whatever came my way. And that was my life, you see. And back in 1987, I think it was 87. No, it was 89. Anyway, I caught another case, and all this is important to tell you about what brought me to here. I caught another case in, I think it was 89, and there was five of us on trial, and there was seven charges. And two of the charges were 15 years, and the rest of them were all life with no parole. And at that time, I like to call the God that I had in my life in those days was my 7-Eleven God. And I mean, what I mean by that is I only went there when I needed something. It was my convenience store kind of God, you know. And today, what I have, the God in my life, is like I fly air God, you know, today. That's what I call my higher power. Today is I fly an air God, you know. If I'm 30,000 feet up in an airplane and we hit turbulence, I don't jump out. And when I'm walking through life today and I hit some turbulence in my life today, I don't bail out because I fly air God today. But in those days, I had my 7-Eleven God, and I went to my 7-Eleven God and I said, God, if you get me out of this one, I'm going to stop doing all this crazy stuff. I'm going to be a good husband and a good father and a good brother and a decent human being. And I meant that. You know what? Every time I ever went to God, I always meant it. With every fiber of my being, I meant it. I just didn't know that you had to do something also. I thought meaning it and wanting it was good enough. And when I got sober, I thought meaning it and wanting to be sober was good enough. And it's not. Wanting to be sober does not equal willing to be sober. There's some things that I got to do here. And so anyway, I made this deal with God, and I went back. Make a long story short, we were on trial for 3.5 months. And you know what? I tried to take a 10-year cop-out on that case, and the DA was not taking any plea bargains because he thought he had a powerful case against us. And he refused any plea bargain from anybody. And 3.5 months later, the jury came back in, and five of us stood up, and the jury said, not guilty, not guilty, not guilty, not guilty, not guilty, right down the line, all 7 charges. And I stood up in that courtroom, and I pumped my chest out, and I looked at the DA, and I said, you asshole. You had me for 10 years, and I'm walking out of here, you fool. And I laughed at him. And I went home, and I kissed the wife, and I hugged the kids, and I pet the dog, and I got my pipe down, and I proceeded to go on a 2-year binge. And sometime in that 2 years binge, my wife, who we were together 17 years, she came up to me and she said, Danny, you're killing yourself and everybody around you, and I can't take no more. I'm out of here. And I want to tell you where my mind was in those days. I went, she's leaving me. She's crazy. Like I was a bargain or something, you know. There's something wrong with her if she wants to leave me. Go ahead, I said. And, you know, and I just left. I just took clothes and got in the car and I left. And I had some friends of mine that were down in Florida, and they kept saying, come on down here, we're making money. And so I was going back and forth from New York to Florida, New York to Florida. And I had my eyes on this restaurant that they had down there in Florida. And I was going to take this restaurant. And back in my neighborhood, see, my neighborhood was called Little Italy, and people come from the other side and they come right to my neighborhood. And so there was this family that just came to my neighborhood, and the guy's name was Luigi, and he was a really nice, hardworking, good, decent man. And I says to him, Luigi, I got my eyes on this restaurant in Florida. Let's go down there. We'll take the place. We'll put it in your name. I don't want to do any work. I don't want to know nothing. You just bring me an envelope every week, and you can have this place. And he said to me, Danny, all I want is for my kids to grow up in America. And I had a part to play in those days, and I used to play it good. And I said, Luigi, not only will your kids grow up in America, but if you stay with me, they'll be rich. And I loaded up this man and his family and moved them to Florida, and we took this place, and I got myself a little condo in this nice development on the second floor. And the restaurant was doing good, and it was making money. And all I wanted to do at this point, see, I had kicked everybody to the curb for another hit already. Everybody that loved me or I loved, I kicked them all to the curb. And all I was living for was another hit. And all I wanted to do was get high. And I was meeting this Colombian guy, and I used to get dope from him. And you see, the insanity of this disease for me is simply this. I can't stop doing that shit. I've got no great philosophy about the insanity of this disease. I can't stop doing it. I don't want to do it. I swear I ain't going to do it no more, but I can't stop. And cocaine took me to a place, like I love what the big book says. The big book says it beat me into a state of reasonableness. The big book says it uses 3 words that I don't know why people have a problem relating to, but if I had no problem relating to it. 3 words in the big book that I related to. Pitiful, incomprehensible, demoralization. Pitiful, incomprehensible, demoralization. That was me at the end. I did things at the end that I swear I would never do. I mean, it was all insanity at the end. The last 2 years of my using was just simply insanity. I could remember getting some dope and going up to the apartment and sitting on the couch, and as soon as I'd hit the pipe, I'd say to my friend, check the window, there's somebody at the window. And he'd look at me and he'd say, We're on the ninth floor. What are they, hovering with wings out there? You see, because he didn't do a hit yet. It was past him a pipe, he'd be talking about check the window too, you know. I could remember towards the end of my using, I could remember one time I said to myself, you're doing too much cocaine, Danny, you need to take a break. And so I said, I'm not going to do any cocaine tonight. And so I called this lady up that I knew that she doesn't get high, and I said, would you like to go to dinner? And she said, sure. And so I got all dressed up, I put a suit on, and I picked her up, and we went to this restaurant, and this particular night it was raining hard. And we're in the restaurant, and I had some dope at the apartment, you know, and we're in the restaurant, and she's talking to me, and the dope is calling her. She's talking to me, you know, and going, huh? And she's talking, and I'm smiling, going, huh? What? And I rushed through the meal, and we jumped in a cab, and we went back to my apartment, and we went inside, and I says to her, sit down, baby, I gotta go to the bedroom, I'll be right out. And she sits down on the couch. Now, mind you, that she didn't get high, she didn't drink, smoke weed, nothing. And so I go into the, get my pipe, and I go into the bedroom, and I shut the door, and I step into the shower, got my suit on, and I hit that bad boy. And I'm in the bedroom about 30 or 40 minutes. I'm sweating like a bastard. And finally, after about 30 minutes, I open the bedroom door, and I'm holding my pants because they're making too much noise. As I tiptoe right by her, like she ain't even there, I tiptoe right by her, and I go to the window, and I peek out the window, and just as I peek out the window, the lightning strikes, and I said, oh shit, they just took my picture. She got up and bolted out of there, man, and ran out the place. And because, you know, it was like Dr. Jekyll went into the bathroom and Mr. Hyde came out. And she got up and ran out of the apartment. You know what I did? I ran behind her and locked the door. I said, thank God she's gone. She was fucking my head up. The insanity of this disease is I can't stop doing it. I don't want to do it. I swear I ain't going to do it no more. You know, I look back on my life today. I look back on it with a clear head today, and I say, geez, I must have been insane. You know what? I could relate that to today. There'd really be no difference. I could have went into the worst neighborhood in the Bronx at 2 in the morning with a bunch of guys hanging on the corner, and I could have took $5,000 and threw it on the floor and say, kick my ass. And they'd take all my money and kick me and stomp me and beat me down, and just as they're leaving, I'd say, hey, I'll see you tomorrow. What's the difference, right? The way we abuse ourselves, what's the difference? Would have been short and sweet like that. So anyway, I'm telling you that I'm down in Florida, and all I'm doing is living for the next hit. And I meet this Colombian guy in the restaurant, and I get a kilo of cocaine. And what I used to do is sometimes I bag that I had, and I put my scale in there, and my daring in there, and the dope in there, and all the paraphernalia in there. And then I did something that I never did before. I put my pistol in there, too. And I never did that, because I was schooled all my life, you never give nobody your pistol. That the biggest insult in the world is to get shot with your own pistol. And so I put my pistol in there and I zipped it up and I went downstairs and I knocked on the guy's door and I said, hold this for me. I'm going to eat something and I'll take care of you. He said, sure, Danny. So I was living in this apartment for a year at this time already. And I went back upstairs and I started making myself something to eat. And here come the DEA. They were watching this Colombian guy. And they bust into my place and they go through the whole apartment and they find nothing. Not even a pistol. Now usually, they grab me for a pistol and I'm 6 months or 12 months, 18 months just on a pistol charge. Nothing. They take me down to Miami. They got me in one room and they got Luigi in the other room and the agent says to me, we found a kilo of cocaine in your restaurant. And me being a stand-up guy I was, I said, I don't own a restaurant. And the agent said to me, we know that's your restaurant. And I said, look, pal, if you found something in a restaurant, it ain't mine. I don't own a restaurant. Do you want to charge me with something? And I called my lawyer, and a couple hours later, they let me go. But they wasn't letting Luigi go. He had a green card. The restaurant was in his name. There was a whole bunch of cocaine in the restaurant. And I went back to my apartment. I knocked on that guy's door. I said, give me that stuff and don't bother me. And I went upstairs. And for 3 days, all I ate for 3 days was about 20 packs of cigarettes, 4 bottles of vodka, and a whole lot of cocaine. Which is really nothing that unusual. But, you know, I just wanted not to feel at that point. At that point in my life, I believe that the end result of drinking or using or whatever your thing is that we all wind up alone and hurting. And at this point in my life, I was alone and I was hurting. And I didn't want to feel. And the phone was ringing. I knew it was Luigi's wife and I didn't want to answer it because there was nothing I could do for him. And I'm cooking up stuff, putting it under pipes so big it's dripping down the sides of the pipe. Just trying to escape. Just didn't want to feel. And I'm sitting there and it's becoming nighttime. It's coming into the third day, nighttime. And all of a sudden, the crickets started cricketing, making their little crickety noise. Now I'm living in this apartment for a year and every night I heard the crickets, but on this particular night, I don't hear that to be the crickets. What I hear that to be is the crackling of the police radios. And I know I'm surrounded. And so now, I'm sitting next to the terrace door, you know, peeping out the windows. You know, I tell you, see, these ain't wrinkles on my face. These are Venetian blind marks from years and years of peeking out the window. And what happened was, what I'm doing is this. I hit the pipe, I put the pipe down, I crawl out to the terrace, I'm looking for the cops because they're all around me, I'm surrounded, right? It's the crickets, right? And I look for a little bit, I crawl back in, I put the pistol down, I hit the pipe, I put the pipe down, I grab the pistol, I crawl back out. And this went on for hours. Put the pipe down, grab the pistol, crawl out, put the pistol down, grab, hit the pipe, put the pipe down, grab the pistol, crawl back out. For hours. And then I heard these words, and it wasn't a hallucination. I really heard somebody say, okay, Sarge, let's go. Ha! I said, that's it. And for the first time in like 4 hours, I got to my feet. I put the pipe down real easy, and grabbed the pistol. And at this point, I want to tell you that where I was in life, I had made a decision. And the big book talks about we made many resolutions, but never a decision. I made a decision that night. The decision was, they ain't taking me to jail. That we're going to hold court, and I'm going to be the judge and the jury and the executioner, and somebody's dying with me, but I ain't going in. I'm too messed up. And when I heard somebody say, okay, Sarge, let's go, I ran to the terrace, and everything I'm going to share with you happened that quick. Fraction of a second. I ran to the terrace. I got the pistol. I reached over and I looked down and there was one guy down there. And I said, one guy for me? Don't they know who I think I am? in that fraction of a second that I looked and I saw one guy, he said it again. He said, okay, Sarge, let's go. And his dog came. He was calling his dog. And he never looked up. He never saw the bug-eyed crazy man on top of him. He doesn't know to this day that he came this close to dying. Unless he's in one of these rooms one of these days, I don't know. I'm waiting one day for somebody to come up to me and say, hey, I lived over there. I had a dog named Sarge, you know. Because I don't know this man. And I came that close to shooting him on top of his head. He never saw me. And I, you know, not only my arm was shaking, but my whole body was shaking. And I reached back, the pistol back in, and I went back inside. And I don't know how I did what I did, except to tell you that the angels came and helped me. Because I picked up that 200-pound phone, and I called New York, and I called my brother. And I said, I'm dying down here, man. I need some help. Now, I want to tell you what kind of miracle that in itself is. See, up to that point in my life, I was 32 years old, almost 33 years old. And up to that point in my life, I'd been a tough guy all my life. I made a living on hurting people. That's how I made my money. And for me to reach out and say, help me, was something that was beyond me. So I know the angels came and helped me with that call. And my brother said, he was in New York. And I was in Florida. He said, I'll be there first thing in the morning. And I hung up the phone with him, and I looked at the pile of dope I had. You know, and I hear people, if people come to the podium, when you come to the podium, I believe anything you say. And people come to the podium, and they say, I hate that stuff. I flush it in the toilet. I put it down the drain. I hate it. I can't stand it. That's not my experience. My brother's coming from New York to Florida to get me. I got about 100 grams left. I'm trying to smoke it up, man. I'm smoking. I'm already up for 3 days. I'm smoking and smoking. My brother gets there the next day, and we drive to the airport, and I'm smoking. And we get on the airplane, and we fly back to New York, and we're 30,000 feet up on the airplane, and it's my fourth day up, and I go to the bathroom, and I shut the door, and I hit the pipe. And I can't come out of the bathroom on the airplane. I'm stuck in the bathroom on the airplane because I know that if I come out, everybody in the plane is going to go. They're waiting for me to come out to look at me. I'm in the bathroom 40, 50 minutes, almost the whole flight. The stewardess is knocking on the door. You okay? She said, no, I don't feel good. And we land in LaGuardia, and I get off the plane. And we drive into Manhattan to the hospital, and I'm smoking all the way. And we pull in front of the hospital, and I just looked at my brother, and I said, go around the block, man. I got some more shit left. He goes around the block a couple of times. He pulls back in front of the hospital. He says, you're not going to be able to finish that. And I said, I can't go in now. I'm too fucked up. Take me home. And I don't know how to tell you that. I don't know what to tell you how I got out of that car and went to that hospital, except to tell you that the angels came and they put their arms on me and they took me out of that car and I crawled into that hospital a broken man. And for 3 days I was able to do nothing for 3 days. I didn't go to a meeting. I couldn't sit in a meeting. I couldn't sit nowhere but the toilet bowl. The first day I slept. The second day I was on the bowl. And the third day my head was a little less foggy and my bowels were a little bit better. And I was able to go to the first meeting that I ever went to in my life. And it was a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous that two women brought up to that hospital that day. And if I live to be 110 and stay sober that whole time, I'll never forget what that lady shared. I'm sitting in this meeting, a broken man. And this lady said, the three most important things in my life, she said, I'm sure there's no doubt in my mind, the three most important things in my life, when I get up each morning, is to make my bed, put the cap on the toothpaste, and hit my knees. And I'm saying, what the hell is she talking about? I'm dying over here. What is she talking about, putting the cap on the toothpaste? I'm in the wrong place. And I got up to leave.
And I don't know how to tell you that I didn't leave, except to tell you the angels came and helped me. And I stayed. And I didn't hear nothing really, those 28 days in treatment there. And I got hooked up with a group, and I was doing the deal, but I want to tell you that my first year or so of sobriety was very, very weird. I went to a lot of meetings, and I was working diligently with my sponsor. But I was leaving meetings and going to after-hour joints. I was leaving meetings and going to gambling joints. And I was crazy. And 1 year sober, I ran here to Atlanta and hid here in Atlanta to escape an indictment. And that's where I met my friend George. Where's George at? That was a long time ago. I was hiding here from an indictment. I'm going to tell you a little later about 2 years sober how I didn't hide from an indictment anymore. But anyway, that was my life in my first year. It was just nuts. So I started doing things, you know. I started doing what your people told me to do. And I want to tell you that I'm not going to go through all the steps for you, and I'm certainly not going to tell you how to work the steps, because there's a book that tells you real good how to work the steps. You get somebody, and might catch on one of these days. It's called The Big Book. And get somebody to help you take the directions out of that book and put them into your life. But, you know, for me, the first step was just, I learned two words in treatment. I want to tell you this. The two words that I learned in treatment are two very little small words. Why and try. And I don't ever remember using those words in my vocabulary until I got sober. In treatment, the counselor would say, Danny, this is what we want you to do. And I'd say, why? And they say, Danny, this is what you got to do. Can you do this? And I say, I'll try. You know what? I never remember trying to get high. I got high. I made it happen. I like to give you my Houdini analogy. My Houdini analogy goes like this. I was like Houdini out there. What I mean by that is, you could have put me in a straitjacket and handcuffed me and wrapped some chains around me and padlock it and fold me over and put me in a box and wrap some chains around the box and padlock it and kick it off into the water and watch me get a hit. I'll get out of all that shit and I will get me a hit. Yet I come into the rooms and my sponsor says, read this chapter we're going to talk about tomorrow. And I say, I'll try. You know, if you're new or nearly new and you're struggling in this deal, I want to tell you that the opportunity for you to get sober is just as much for you as anybody else in this room. And that right in the very second sentence of how it works, it tells us who's going to get sober, who's not going to get sober, and why. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program. That means to me that I better come learn how to come in here and chase recovery the way I chased that shit out there. Because, you know, I hear people say some crazy things in the room. They tell people, just say no. I heard that. I heard somebody say that one day. I almost fell off my chair. Just say no. You want to tell a dope fiend like me to just say, I'll rip your heart out for another hit of dope. What do you mean, just say no? That's like telling a homeless person, hey, homeless person, just get a house. Just get a house. You won't be homeless. Doesn't make any sense. I gotta completely give myself. I gotta do what I don't want to do. Because you know what? I love cocaine. And I don't like people telling me what to do. Now that's a hell of a predicament for us when we get here. Love cocaine? Don't like being told what to do. Shit. In order for me to get this deal, I must really have to work hard. Because I don't like you telling me what to do, and I love this, and you're telling me don't touch this and do this. It's not an easy thing. It's not an easy thing. But you know what? I already said it. Cocaine beat me into a state of reasonableness. Yeah. You see, and Bill writes in the 12 and 12 in step one, he says that I don't got to convince you to get sober. That John Barleycorn is our best advocate. You see, so when I work with people today, they say to me, I want to do a hit so bad. Should we tell me for ain't the dope man? You want to go get a hit? Go to 23rd Street, make a right. There's a place right there. They give you. If you come to me and say, they say, but you're supposed to help me. No. You come to me and say, oh man, I really don't want to do a hit so bad I don't know how. Now, that's what I'm here for. I got something for your ass then. You see, because I have been sober for 3,425 days in a row, weekends and holidays included. And you know what? Because sometimes you hear people say, and people come up to the podium and they say, you know, with rooms like this and a God of my understanding and people like you, I haven't found it necessary to take a hit or a drink since blah, 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 blah. And I'm going to tell you that in the last 3,425 days, I have found it necessary many times to take a hit of dope. And in the last 3,425 days, I have found it necessary many times to have a drink. But for one reason or another, for one meeting or another, for one prayer or another, for one addict or another, I have always found it more necessary not to. One day at a time, sometimes 2 minutes at a time. So I tell you, when I got to the second step, and I'm not stupid, okay? And see, I knew in step two that you were talking about God. You can't fool me, you said higher power. I knew you were talking about God. And to me, see, God died when I was 10 years old. My father was God. That's the kind of home I came from. My mother was an angel and my father was God. And so I spent 20-something years trying to take my father's place and be God. And I didn't get sober to talk about God or find God. I didn't want to have nothing to do with God. I was agnostic. I believed there was a God, but it didn't have nothing to do with me. And a guy came up to me after meeting one time and he says to me, at that time I had two daughters, and he said, Danny, let me ask you a question. He said, if your oldest daughter became a prostitute, would you hate her? And I said, no, I wouldn't hate my daughter. And he said, if your other daughter became a junkie and was hitting people upside their head, old ladies taking their pocketbook, would you hate her? And I said, no, I wouldn't hate my daughter. And he said, and you believe in God, right? And I said, yeah, there's a God. And he said, well, let me see if I can run this back to you then. You're telling me that you have the capacity to love your children unconditionally, no matter what they do or what's happening in their life, and you know there's a God, but you don't think that God has the capacity to love you in spite of what you've done. You know, for the first time in my life, I had to take a look at this thing that I call God. And I told you already that today I can stand here, look in the eye, and tell you that God loves me just as I am. You know, and I spent a lot of time in this program worrying about this God thing, you know, because all my life I was a Roman Catholic upbringing, you know, and God was up there, you know, in heaven. And I just, you know, couldn't get personal with somebody way up there, you know. And what the book tells me is that the great reality lies deep within me. That in the last analysis, only there can be found that God is in me. That God's not up there trying to get in here. God's in here. He's trying to get out there and mingle with you. And God's in you and he wants to get out and mingle with me. And that God is right here. And when I start removing all the resentments and the fears and the anger and the anxieties and all the things that the steps do, remove these things that block me from God, it gets like E.T. and the love light starts shining and God comes out and I can't help it. And step three, for me, I made a couple of real common mistakes. I say they're common mistakes because I work with a lot of people, and I see them making the same mistake. And the first one that I made was, I thought I had to do God's will in step three. I didn't even know what my will was in step three. How am I going to do God's will? And the other mistake that I made in step three was there was this saying going around the rooms, and it's still around the rooms. It's a really good saying. Only a dolphin like me, if they don't have any guidance, can misuse it. And the saying was, let go and let God. Give it to God. And so I had this problem, and I went to my sponsor, and he said, wow, what are you going to do about that, Danny? And I said, give it to God. And he said, oh, really? About a week later, I still got the same problem, and I went back to him, and I said, what's up with this? I gave this to God last week. And he said, Danny, God don't want that shit either. You see, there's nothing in step three that relieves me of the responsibility of taking action. And I thought there was. I thought I'll just give it to God and that's it. And I kept missing that little four-letter word in step three. It says the care of God. Care of God, which means I do the work and I leave the results to the care of God. That ain't my job, the results. But it is my job to do the work. And that God won't do for me what I could do for myself. And what happened for me was, somewhere along the way, about 2 years sober, I went to see an army buddy of mine and wound up staying out there in Oklahoma City. It was just what God ordered for me. Because there was no more gambling joints and there was no more nightclubs and after-hour joints, and it was just what I needed, you see, and that's what I needed for me to really start doing things in this program. And Cocaine Anonymous did not really exist over there in Oklahoma City. Today we have a powerful fellowship over there, and I look back now and I say, of course, this was God. You know, and you cannot go against God's will. It's impossible. So anyway, what happens is I'm living in Oklahoma City. I want to fly back to New York to get my 2-year medallion from the group that I got sober with, my home group there in New York. And so I do that, and I get my 2-year medallion, I get my cake, and the next day I'm taking my daughters shopping in Manhattan. And a lot of people know what Manhattan's like. The sidewalks are real big, and all of a sudden, I was hit with this desire to get high. And I got the 2-year medallion in my pocket. And in the 2 years, I really didn't have that powerful of a desire. And I counted my money. And I said, when the kids come out of the store, I'm going to take them home. And I'm going to go get loaded. And then I remember that there was a line in the book that said, there's going to come a point in all our sobriety that no human power could do. We're going to have a desire to drink that no human power could do anything about, but God could. And I remember reading that in the book, so I looked up. I said, God, please help me, because I don't want to use as much as I want to use. And he saved me, and I'll tell you what happened. I looked down the street, and I was about 4 stores up the block, and on the corner, this guy had this stand set up, and he was selling these little wooden plaques of animals that were shellacked, like an elephant and it was, or a tiger, but all of them were animals. But in the middle of this whole big thing was one that was writing, and from where I was just drawn to it, and I just kind of walked to it in a daze. And I'm going to read it for you, because I always share this from the podium because it saved my life. And I got up to this thing, and it said, and in big print it said, the letter: Dear friend, how are you? I just had to send a note to tell you how much I care about you. I saw you yesterday as you were talking with your friends. I waited all day hoping you would want to talk with me too. I gave you a sunset to close your day and a cool breeze to rest you, and I waited. You never came. It hurt me, but I still love you because I am your friend. I saw you sleeping last night and longed to touch your brow, so I spilled moonlight upon your face. Again, I waited, wanting to rush down so we could talk. I have so many gifts for you. You awoke and rushed off to work. My tears were in the rain. If you would only listen to me, I love you. I try to tell you in blue skies and in the quiet green grass. I whispered in leaves on the trees and breathed in colors of flowers. Shouted to you in mountain streams and give the birds love songs to sing. I clothe you with warm sunshine and perfume the air with nature's scents. My love for you is deeper than the ocean and bigger than the biggest need in your heart. Ask me. Talk with me. Please don't forget me. I have so much to share with you. I won't hassle you any further. It is your decision. I have chosen you and I will wait. I love you. Your friend, Jesus. So I bought that plaque and my kids came out of the store and they said, "What's that, Dad?" And I said, "Oh, just a little something I needed today." And I was out of it. And God did for me what I couldn't do for myself. And I believe that up to that point, you see, the book says all our sobriety. It doesn't say it's going to happen to you, you, not you, and you, you, and not you. He said all our sobriety. There's going to come a time. And I believe that that's what's the difference between the people that go back out and the people that don't. Up to that point, have you been doing everything humanly possible for your sobriety? And I was up to that point. And so God did for me what I couldn't do for myself. You know what? I want to tell you this. I know why I'm sober today. And I don't make any bones about it, and I don't pretend. It's not because I'm a great guy. It's not because I'm all that. And it's not because of anything, but for one simple reason. I have the ability to help somebody else that suffers from what I suffer from. And I don't want to ever forget that that's why I'm sober. And if you got any sobriety and sitting here tonight and you're not doing that, shame on you, because you ain't all that either. And that we got some payback for God to do, and God's got some work for us, and we better be carrying that out. And I want to ask you people to just bear with me a couple more minutes and I'll get out of here. But just so the new people can see, and please don't raise your hand if you really don't believe this, but do you believe that, how many people have a higher power in their life tonight? Right, raise your hand. Now please, keep your hand up if you believe the most important thing in your life is that relationship with that higher power tonight.
Yes.
Look at this.
Yes.
That's powerful. Thank you. Thank you. I want to read something for you out of the book real quick, and for the new people to understand. On page 50 in the big book, it says, "Here are thousands of men and women, worldly indeed. They flatly declare that since they have come to believe in a power greater than themselves, to take a certain attitude toward that power and do certain simple things, there has been a revolutionary change in their way of living and thinking. In the face of collapse and despair, in the face of total failure of their human resources, they found that a new power, peace, happiness, and sense of direction flowed into them. This happened soon after they wholeheartedly met a few simple requirements. Once confused and baffled by the seemingly futility of existence, they show the underlying reasons why they were making heavy going of life. Leaving aside the cocaine question, they tell why living was so unsatisfactory. They show how the change came over them. When many hundreds of people are able to say that the consciousness of the presence of God is today the most important fact of their lives, they present a powerful reason why one should have faith. So if you're new and you saw some hundreds of hands go up telling you that this is the kind of room that people in this room did things that I did and worse or not as bad, but there's some devious son of a guns in this room tonight. And there's some people that have gone all the way down the scale and they're not afraid to tell you how far down the scale they have gone. And they tell you how important God is. I'm going to share with you a couple of quick miracles. The first one was after I told you that thing with 2 years sober, I took the first thing smoking out of town, got out of New York, went back to Oklahoma City, and the next month I was indicted by the federal government, Southern District of New York. A little bit over 2 years sober, and this time I did not run to Atlanta. This time I did not run and hide in a hospital. This time I went back to New York and surrendered myself to the FBI. And it was only a 10-year charge that I was facing. But my lawyer said to me, Danny, you're a three-time loser. The judge could go out of the guidelines and give you life with no parole. And I said, let me call you back tomorrow. I'll tell you what I want to do. And I did what you people taught me to do. I talked about it. I wrote about it. I prayed about it. And I called my lawyer back and I said, I did it. Plead guilty. And I want to tell you that people came from all over the place and sent letters to this judge. And what happened was the judge on my case died, and a newly appointed federal judge took the case, and it was his first case, and my lawyer said, this is not good, we got to get a postponement. And I said, no, we're not postponing nothing. See, a guy told me one time in a meeting, he said, Danny, don't matter what the judge wants to do, because you're doing the right thing. And when the time comes, whatever the judge wants to do, the angels are going to touch him, and you're going to go free. And I said, cool, man. And then in an AA meeting one day, a drunk says to me, maybe God wants you to carry the message behind the wall in the prison. And I said, man, leave it to the drunks to screw things up. And what happened was I had a lot of fear and I had a lot of faith. And I did the next right thing in front of me. And I stood in front of that. I went to get a pre-sentence report, and the probation officer recommended 7 years incarceration. And that was good, too, with my record. And I stood in front of that judge the next February, and he told me, stand up, and my legs were shaking. And what happened was I knew I had changed, because when I surrendered myself, they put me in a holding cell. Bail was being arranged for me, and I felt uncomfortable. And I have never felt uncomfortable in jail before. But I knew that I was different. I didn't belong in there. And when the judge asked me to stand up, I stood up. He says, you got anything to say? I says, Your Honor, the only thing I could tell you is that paper in front of you is me and I did it. The person in front of you is somebody different. And I didn't know what else to say. And he held up a stack of papers this thick. Letters that people sent on my behalf. I didn't ask nobody to write no letters. Faxes. People called the judge. He says, I want you to know I got all of these things about you, and they're very impressive. I read them all. He said, I also want you to know that I got somebody like you in my courtroom, and 7 years is a joke. You're not getting anything like 7 years in here. And I knew he was about to whack me with some heavy time. He was telling me he was going to whack me with some heavy time. And then the angels came. I saw them. I didn't see the angels, but I saw them, because he picked up his thing, and as he was going to whack it down and sentence me, he said, and I don't know why I'm going to do what I'm going to do, and he gave me a 5-year suspended sentence. And he hit me with a fine. A huge fine. Humongous fine. Like, he really broke me with the fine, but I was like free, and I went, yeah, my lawyer hugged me, and then the judge like snapped out of it. He said, like, what the hell did I just do? Lock that guy up till he comes up with some money. And you know what? I'm not telling you if you get sober, you're not going to have to go to jail. I ain't telling you that. I'm telling you that I saw the angels touch this man for me. And that I understand that God wants me to be more useful out here for him. And do his work out here. And what is his work? Carrying this beautiful message to those that are sober. Bringing some hope to the hopeless. That's what we're about, people. That's everything in a nutshell for us. Bringing hope to the hopeless. God did for me, again, what I couldn't do for myself. I want to tell you, you know what? You're looking at a Dolphine that went to the 6th grade in school. Never went to the 7th grade. I had to get a driver's license because when I was 16, I got a driver's license. When I was 17, I lost it. And I was 32, almost 33 when I got sober. I had to get a driver's license. You try to explain to those people where you've been for 22 years. I told my sponsor I'm going to lie to him. He said, what are you going to say? I got to tell him I was overseas. He said, tell him what you got to tell him. 22 years I didn't have a license. You know what? I've been a felon ever since I'm 13 years old. I've never been allowed to vote. 2 years ago, I finished all my paper with everything I ever owed the government. For the first time ever in my life, this year that just passed, I voted. Really wasn't what I thought it would be, but I voted. I got a driver's license. I went back to school. Last summer, I got my master's degree. I ain't telling you all this to brag. I'm telling you this to... Unbelievable, this program, what you could do. When you channel this energy that we used out there to do those crazy things, channel it over here in recovery. Do God's work and anything is possible for you. Anything is possible for you. They gave me a passport. I went to England a few weeks ago. I got a under my name, I got a passport. Go figure that one. I'm going to tell you this and I'm going to shut up. I know. I am positive. There's no doubt in my mind the three most important things that I got to do each morning when I get up is to make my bed, put the cap on the toothpaste, and hit my knees. Thank you for letting me share with you.